Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome what? To Mind Matters, the show in which I discuss all matters of the mind, in which I show how much mind matters. Welcome to part 39 of Control Your Brain, Control Your Life. I am Bruce Latzbuchler, and I'm live on air. You can call in at any time with questions and comments on the subject I'm talking about. If you have any questions, comments, and suggestions not related to the subject matter, please go to my website, mindmattersonline.info. Mind Matters Online is one word. There you'll find my email address and then write to me. I will reply within 48 hours. The same, of course, applies also if you cannot get through with your calls to this show. On my website, you will find also the last 20 or so recordings of my show and a link that directs you to the Blog Talk Radio archive in which you will find all my shows, old and new. Last week, I talked about attitude and health and personality and how this can affect you in your quest for health or getting well and speeding up healing processes. Today I'm going to talk about placebos, why and how they work, and what we can learn from it. I will then carry on talking about something I mentioned also last week, which is self-actualization, or how to become the best you can. You will see how this fits into our health and health personality theme. There may be a few people who do not know what placebo means, and for those, I need to explain it and shed also some more light on placebo for those who have just a bit of an understanding of it. A placebo is anything that seems to be a real medical treatment, but isn't. It could be a pill, a shot, or some other type of fake treatment, a sugar-coated pill, for example. What all placebos have in common is that there's nothing in them that can treat a medical condition. Researchers use placebos also during studies to help them understand what effect a new drug or some other treatment might have on a particular condition. For instance, some people in a study might be given a new drug to lower cholesterol. Others would get a placebo. None of the people in the study will know if they got the real treatment or the placebo. Researchers then compare the effects of the drug and the placebo on the people in the study. That way they can determine the effectiveness of the new drug and check also for side effects. Sometimes a person can have a response to a placebo. The response can be positive or negative. For instance, the person's symptoms may improve, or the person may have what appears to be a side effect from the treatment. These responses are known as the placebo effect. There are some conditions in which a placebo can produce results, even when people know they are taking a placebo. Studies show that placebos can have an effect on conditions such as depression, pain, sleeping disorder, irritable bowel syndrome, and quite a few more. In one study involving asthma, people using a placebo inhaler did not better on breathing tests than sitting and doing nothing. But when a researcher asked for people's perception of how they felt, the placebo inhaler was reported as being as effective as medicine in providing relief. Research on the placebo effect has focused on the relationship of mind and body. One of the most common theories is that the placebo effect is due to a person's expectation. If a person expects a pill to do something, then it's possible that the body's own chemistry can cause effects similar to what a medication might have caused. For instance, in a study, people were given a placebo and told it was a stimulant. After taking the pill, their pulse rate sped up, their blood pressure increased, and their reaction speeds improved. When people were given the same pill and told it was to help them get to sleep, they experienced the opposite effect. Experts also say that the relationship between how strongly a person expects to have results and whether or not results occur. The stronger the feeling, the more likely it is that a person will experience positive effects. The same appears to be true for negative effects. If people expect to have side effects such as headaches, nausea, or drowsiness, there's a greater chance of those reactions to happen. The fact that the placebo effect is tied to the expectations doesn't make it imaginary. Some studies show that there are actual physical changes that occur with the placebo effect. For instance, some studies have documented an increase in the body's production of endorphins, one of the body's natural pain relievers. Then there's also something that has been given the rather unfortunate name, nocebo. Nocebo does the opposite. A drastic example could be the individual who firmly believes that the medication he has been prescribed doesn't work, and then it really doesn't work. As I said, the placebo effect to some degree is based on expectation, the expectation that the treatment will help. But expectations can also do harm. When a patient anticipates a pill's possible side effects, he can suffer them even if the pill is fake. This nocebo effect has been largely overlooked by researchers, clinicians, and also patients. A study in Germany found that 11% of people in fibromyalgia drug trials who were taking fake medication dropped out of the studies because of side effects like dizziness or nausea. Other researchers reported that the discontinuation rates because of side effects in placebo groups in migraine or tension drug trials were also quite significant. In a curious study, a team of Italian scientists asked people with and without diagnosed lactose intolerance to take lactose for an experiment on its effect on bowel symptoms. But in reality, the participants received glucose, which does not harm the gut. Nonetheless, 44% of the people with known lactose intolerance and 26% of those without lactose intolerance complained of gastrointestinal symptoms. In one remarkable case, a participant in an antidepressant drug trial was given placebo tablets, and then he swallowed 26 of them in a suicide attempt. Even though the tablets were placebo and totally harmless, the participant's blood pressure dropped perilously slow. The nocebo effect can be observed even when people take real, non-placebo drugs. When medical professionals inform patients of possible side effects, the risk of experiencing those side effects can increase. In one trial, a drug was administered to men to relieve symptoms of prostate enlargement. Half of the patients were told that the drug could cause erectile dysfunction, while the other half was not informed of this possible side effect. In the informed group, 44% of the participants reported that they experienced erectile dysfunction. In the uninformed group, that figure was only 15%. In a similar experiment, a group of German psychologists took patients with chronic lower back pain and divided them into two groups for a leg flexion test. One group was told that the test could lead to a slight increase in pain, while the other group was told that the test had no effect on pain level. The first group reported stronger pain and performed fewer leg flexions than the second group did. A doctor's choice of words also matters. A team of American doctors studied women about to give birth who were given an injection of a local anesthetic before being administered an epidural. For some women, the injection was prefaced by the statement, "We are going to give you a local anesthetic that will numb the area so that you will be comfortable during the procedure, namely the epidural." For the other group, the statement was, "You're going to feel a big bee sting. This is the worst part of the procedure." Now guess what? The perceived pain was significantly greater after the latter statement, which emphasized the downside of the injection. The nocebo effect presents doctors and nurses with an ethical dilemma. On one hand, they are required to tell patients about the potential complications of a treatment. On the other hand, they want to minimize the likelihood of side effects. But if merely telling patients about side effects increases their likelihood, what is to be done? Better communication would be my answer. When talking with patients, doctors and nurses often say things with unintended negative suggestions, like, "It's just going to bleed a bit," or, "You must avoid lifting heavy objects. You don't want to end up paralyzed." I would recommend more extensive training in your communication for doctors and nurses to help them use the power of their words appropriately. As the great cardiologist Bernard Laun once said, "Words are the most powerful tool a doctor possesses. But words, like a two-edged sword, can maim as well as heal." Placebos and nocebos have been discovered to be activated outside the conscious mind, which explains why patients show clinical improvement even when given treatment without active ingredients. Previous research has suggested you do not need to get a placebo effect. Placebo effects can be potentially active in any therapeutic situation. In a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, it was found that placebo and nocebo effects depend on brain function that are separate from cognitive consciousness. It has always been believed that placebo responses were linked to conscious thought. For instance, when people have the expectation to get better, they will. Or in the case of nocebos, they will deteriorate because they expect to get worse. More recently, scientists have learned humans expect threat or reward quickly and automatically, without needing to form the idea in their head consciously. As the authors explain, certain structures like the amygdala and the striatum can process stimuli before they reach conscious awareness and can bring about non-conscious effects on human behavior and cognition. Two experiments were conducted using 40 volunteers. In the first, researchers gave heat stimulation to the participants' arms and showed them pictures of human male faces at the same time. The first image was related to with low pain prompts, while the second was related to high pain prompts. Afterwards, patients rated their experience on a pain scale of 0 to 100, 0 being no pain and 100 being the worst, without the knowledge that all heat stimulations carried the same heat intensity. As anticipated, And as you by now may have guessed, pain ratings correlated with learned associations. Subjects reported a pain rating of 19 when seeing the low pain phase, while 53 was the most commonly reported number on the pain scale while seeing the high pain phase, exhibiting a nocebo effect, of course. In the second experiment, subjects were given the same levels of heat stimulation. The same photos were shown, but only flashing by quickly, so patients could not recognize them. Then participants rated their pain again, showing a placebo effect to the low pain phase at a mean rate of 25. In response to the high pain phase, a mean rate of 44 was recorded, or a nocebo effect. Such a mechanism would generally be expected to be more automatic and fundamental to our behavior compared to deliberate judgments and expectations. Most important, this study provides a unique model that allows us to further investigate placebo and nocebo mechanisms by using tools such as neuroimagining. We not only know that placebos do work, we know there is a hierarchy of effectiveness. Placebo surgery works better than placebo injections. Placebo injections work better than placebo pills. Sham acupuncture treatment works better than a placebo pill. Capsules work better than tablets. Big pills work better than small. The more doses a day, the better. The more expensive, the better. The color of the pill makes a difference. Telling the patient this will relieve your pain works better than saying this might help. Basically, when we think something will work, its chances of doing so increase dramatically. What's effective is not the placebo, meaning the benefit patients derive from a dummy pill, but the meaning of the treatment. The power of the effect depends on four variables: expectancy, motivation — the motivation would be the desire to improve one's health, of course — a certain amount of conditioning, including from advertising, and endogenous opiates, or pain-relieving chemicals produced in the brain, which copy the effect of pain relievers such as opiates. I have a copy of the Kirsch report from 1998, in which the doctors Irving Kirsch and Guy Sapirstein researched the effects of placebos on people with depression. They found that the placebo effect was constant across different medications, and that there was hardly any difference in the outcome between the medicated people and those who used placebos. This, of course, also indicates that the placebo component of the response to medication is considerably greater than the pharmacological effect. Talking about depression, I have found in my practice that much better than medication or placebo tablets, talking therapy works much, much, much better. Talking about psychotherapy then, is psychotherapy a placebo? After all, psychotherapeutic hypnosis, which I have used in my practice countless times, is based on expectation and also on suggestion. But then we have also other techniques. Some of them belong to the category of talking therapy and others not. Techniques that help our clients overcome certain problems. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or in short, EMDR, is one of them. However, at the end of the day, it is the quality of the relationship between the therapist and the client that is, in my opinion, the primary curative factor in psychotherapy. So, I would therefore argue that psychotherapy is both a placebo and a real treatment. Well, real, for want of a better word, of course. What this all means is that placebos do work in as much as the mind and its sometimes unconscious effects are incredibly powerful instruments in any form of treatment, and that we are getting only half the story in focusing so relentlessly on biology and genes to the expense of so much else. What else does it mean? I can walk on glowing coal with bare feet without burning them. Nothing special. Many thousands of people can do the same. I can bend spoons and other objects just by using the power of my mind. Again, it's nothing special. Many people can do the same. I can increase or decrease my heart rate and my blood pressure at will. Nothing special. Many people can do the same too. Everybody could do all this if they prepare themselves for it and train and increase their mind power. But what else could we do if only we train some more and increase our power some more or much more? I don't know. I do not have the answer to this question. But one thing is absolutely clear to me. We could do much, much, much more. In one part of this health mini-series, I said that we cannot cure ourselves from cancer without medicine, and I still believe it. But I also said that we can contribute immensely by utilizing all the powers that we have, the power of mind, of imagination, of expectation, in short, everything. And this is also something I firmly believe. Actually, I know it because I act like that. I do everything I can. So far, I'm only somewhat successful, but I believe that there will come the day on which I will say, I am healthy again. So, what can you do to arrive at a stage in your life where you have this power to really master your life? How can you become the best you can be? How can you push aside the limitations that you have set yourself? The limitations that you set when you say, I am too old to do that. I am not educated enough, or whatever you tell yourself. I mentioned in my talks a few times self-actualization, which means being the best you are, but it goes beyond your limitations. When it comes to self-actualization, the very term implies that we have a self to develop. It implies there's a core you and that you as a person are made to develop. It implies that there are possibilities and potential within you to unleash, to grow, to evolve, to develop so that you become more and more you, more and more of what you can become. It implies also that you are not finished yet. Self-actualization also implies that there is within you the possibility of your best self and a higher self. It was a great Abraham Maslow, someone committed to the scientific model, who actually wrote a book on science, and it was a Psychology of Science, which was published in 1966. Someone who began as a behaviorist and studied with leading behaviorists in his time, and who launched a third force in psychology, who launched also the Journal of Humanistic Psychology. It was that person who discovered that we have within our biology the possibility of a higher self. This higher self is biological and inherent in our nature. It emerges as a need, a higher need, as we learn how to effectively and adequately gratify our lower so-called animal needs. Both sets of needs, lower and higher, are equally valid and important because they work together as a system of drives. The lower need needs creates a foundation for the higher needs. And as we learn to adequately gratify the lower needs with true satisfier and not false substitutes, the driving motivation of our lower needs go away. They disappear. And what emerges is the next level need, the next level drive. And it is in this emergence that the higher self arises. So, in self-actualizing, you learn about yourself, about your true nature. You discover your lower nature and how to cope with the lower needs of surviving, which is food, shelter, money, activity, safety and security, which is structure, order, protection. And then you go to the social needs, which is love, affection, bonding, connection. And self-regard, which is value, status, significance. These are basic needs that also animals have, that are all of the higher and more intelligent animals have these needs. At the level of the lower needs, knowing yourself means knowing yourself in terms of these drives, what they are, how they work, what feelings they trigger inside you, how to satisfy them, how to go beyond them, and so on. These needs are not bad or evil. They are just drives of our organism for living and thriving so that we can feel good and make an effective adjustment to life as it is. Yes, yet these are also deficiency needs. That is, deficiency is the mechanism that drives us when we experience need at this level. We don't have enough, not enough food, not enough water, shelter, sex, money, safety, structure, touch, contact, bonding, friends, regard, value, significance, and so on and so on and so on. We lack. We are deficient of the very factors that satisfy the requirements of life. But, and this is an amazing thing, when we find a true satisfier and learn how to adequately cope with these requirements, the need goes away. At that point, we often then experience post-gratification, forgetting how driving the need was. At this point, also the truly human drives kick in. Each level of need is prepotent and keeps us occupied there until it's basically gratified. Once it is sufficiently satisfied, then the next level emerges, and with the gratification of the lower needs, the higher needs emerge. Now, we need things that satisfy our best self, our higher self. And what are these things? They are the human drives for meaning, for purpose, beauty, order, justice, fairness, contribution, legacy, love, goodness, truth, honesty, aliveness, uniqueness, playfulness, completeness, and some more. It is at this level that you can discover and know your highest self. And this is where you can increasingly become more and more of who you really are. Nor is it a process that ever ends. What is the purpose of life? It is to be and to become. It is to keep learning, growing, changing, and developing as you keep moving up higher and higher levels of values. This makes life an adventure. It also keeps you young, curious, playful, and fascinated. It keeps you in the state of continuous freshness of appreciation. It gets you thinking about collaborating, cooperating, giving, and contributing. So, what about you and your self-actualization? When you say that you can't actualize your own potential, is there a particular potential that you want to actualize but having difficulties with? Actually, I have noticed this in several people. The way they think about self-actualization is that it is something more than human, something beyond the everyday human experience. Yet, it is not. the term self-actualization is actually quite a modest term. From the perspective of the great psychologist Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it is simply your higher needs for that which is uniquely human. Meaning, order, structure, contribution, giving love, fairness, excellence, and so on. And just as the lower needs arise biologically as an innate and organic facet of your growth and development, so do your higher needs. It's for these reasons that we don't have to elevate them to make them sound like something more than a person can do. Self-actualization doesn't refer to something mystical or extraordinary. In fact, Maslow said that self-actualization is not a human being with something added. No, self-actualization is a human being with nothing taken away. When you begin living the self-actualizing life, you are simply being true to yourself, to your nature, to human nature, to your gifts and talents, and to your highest and best. You don't need to glorify self-actualization as if it is just for the few. No, it's for everyone. Every baby is wired biologically to grow, to develop, and to actualize its potential. Now, it is true that most people have it beaten out of them by their parents and teachers, or dampened by the way they are socialized. But it is a possibility for all. And while it does have to be chosen and purposefully developed, it is for anyone who chooses and acts. I like to think about self-actualization as seeing to fully and completely be what you are capable of being. It is seeking to be fully alive, fully human. And yes, I do acknowledge that numerous forces and factors can make this difficult. There are educational, cultural, religious, psychological, and political ideas and beliefs that divert us from this and would seduce us to be something else. For human beings, being fully human is the challenge of our lives. What makes me say that? Because it means embracing our fallibility. Well, we have to realize we can be and often are wrong. It means embracing our mortality. After all, we are not immortals. We are mortals who are subject to accidents and illness and who can die at any time. And it means embracing our spirituality. We need meaning to life, and without significant meaning, we lose heart and become dispirited. And knowing these things, the things that we are often wrong, we shall die and we need meaning, requires a lot of ego strength. Otherwise, it activates defense mechanism against that awareness. It activates denial and rejection. It looks to find something or someone who will save us from these frightening realities. So instead of being fully fallibly and mortally human, we seek out all kinds of ways of hiding from the truth. We pretend that we are perfect, above criticism, loved by all, approved by all, saved by knowledge, saved by religion, saved by money, saved by popularity, saved by, well, whatever you pretend to be saved by. It is tough being an authentic human being. Why? Primarily because being real or authentic feels vulnerable. When you are authentically real, you are authentically aware of being fallible, mortal, and spiritual. And that goes against almost everything you learn in being socialized. Our cultures teach us to be strong, knowledgeable, on top, successful. It violates our self-image and social image to acknowledge that there are things we don't know, things about which we are often wrong, that we make mistakes, misunderstand, misbelieve, misspeak, and also misbehave. Living the self-actualizing life is both easy and hard. It is easy in that you were born for it. It fits your inner nature. It brings out your highest values and visions about life and your best skills and competencies. But it is also hard. It requires that you know yourself, accept both your strengths and weaknesses, embrace your humanity, use your fallibility for ongoing learning and adjustments, and not get lost in your roles, personas, and social images. And that's why a commitment to truth, to reality, to being authentic, lies at the heart of actualizing. It takes personal mastery, the discipline of continually clarifying and deepening our personal vision, of focusing our energies, of developing patience, and of seeing reality as objectively as we can, to develop the learning power, to keep discovering things and translating those things to reality. It takes this self-actualizing development of clarifying the things that really matter to us. Real learning gets to the heart of what it means to be human. Through learning, we recreate ourselves. Through learning, we become able to do something we never were able to do. Through learning, we reperceive the world and our relationship to it. Through learning, we extend our capacity to create, to be part of the generative process of life. We expand our capacity to create our future. Animals just know. Humans learn. Animals have the knowledge inside, which is instinct. Humans get the information from outside. Animals have very limited ability to add to their knowledge base. Humans have unlimited learning capacity. The gap of not knowing which our lack of instincts creates simultaneously opens up a space for learning, for the creativity of defining what something is, figuring out how it works, deciding on its value to us, constructing theories of understanding, inventing new levels of knowledge, entering semantic and symbolic world, and experiencing all of the uniquely human constructs of culture and civilization. Learning is creativity, creating and inventing at all levels of meaning that are available to human beings. Our learning constructs our sense of reality as we map out our understandings. And in this way, we can create life as a heaven or as hell. How real are you? Are you your real self? How much do you live your life to express your authentic self with your highest possibilities and actualizing your best potentials? That's what the self-actualizing life is all about, creating and living the best version of you that you can contribute and make a difference. You were made for that, and your potentials clamor for that. And if you try to shut all of that down, you only doom yourself to being unhappy for the rest of your life. What this means is that your vitality is related to and dependent on you discovering and being your best self, your real self. The wisdom within this actually goes far, far beyond Maslow to the ancient Greeks, who made this one of the points of wisdom: know yourself. In self-actualization psychology, Maslow forged the way beyond the empty slate idea to the realization that each of us are born with unique features and possibilities, potentials, our dispositions, and uniqueness. We are born human. We are human. We do not need to learn how to become human. But we are not born fully ourselves. we become. We don't arrive on the scene with instincts. We don't come out of the womb and can run and jump. We develop. All this relates directly to your sense of vitality in life. If you want to dampen your energies, reduce the quality of your vitality, try to be someone else. Try to conform to a mold that's established at school, in the media, by your culture, by Hollywood, or by any group. If you succeed, you will fail at being you. You will fail at being authentic and knowing yourself, and with that, you won't know your best gifts and contributions. So you'll feel like a fraud. You'll evaluate yourself as up or down, depending on local circumstances. You'll suffer identity crises. You won't know what you like, your values, your unique potentials. And in the long run, that will undermine your joy of life and your basic vitality. Another way to dampen your energies is to reduce your vitality and diminish yourself as a person. Try to be what you are not. Try to be perfect. Well, that's a great way to ruin a perfectly good, fallible human being. At first you'll have lots of energy and effort, but then you'll over-prepare and begin to procrastinate and hyper-worry about flaws and fill your mind and body with anxiety and with the fear to fail. Well, this will make your life a party. Some people told me that they try to be totally positive and never negative, and at first it seemed to them like a great strategy. But then, whenever they had an experience that did not fit that mental box of positive, they had to distort their experience and they had to pretend. After some time, it didn't work for them anymore, and then, of course, they gave up quite soon. I've mentioned before that we need to accept negativity because it does indeed exist. Not only that, but positivity needs negativity and optimism needs pessimism. Just as day needs night, good needs evil, and beauty needs ugliness. This is perfect because it doesn't really matter that we encounter negatives, perhaps even on a daily basis. What does matter, though, is how we react to it. When your life energy is dimmed down, depressed, empty, or diminished, you may be wasting your energies. You could be wasting them fighting some phantom in your mind like the need to be perfect or positive or never fallible, never vulnerable, never or not mortal. The paradox is that your vitality for life comes more alive, with more energy, when you fully embrace your true nature as a weak, fallible, and mortal person. Look at any young child, weak, fallible, vulnerable, and fully alive to the mystery, excitement, and fascination of life. It is the same as I explained a short while ago. We accept that we are vulnerable simply because we are vulnerable, or mortal, or fallible. And it does not really matter to accept it, because firstly, acceptance is the first thing, and I spoke about this in some previous show. Secondly, because we cannot change our mortality, we can accept it and then can relax about it. I am once again running out of time. I had it in my ear that I have to shut down. Right, I continue next week. Until then, thank you for listening. Go to my website and mindmattersonline.info, and mindmattersonline is one word. There you'll find my email address, and then you can write to me. I look forward to receiving your comments, suggestions, and any questions that you like to ask. If you have any problems you want to tell me about, let me know, and I assure you of my best possible advice. I will reply to all your emails within 48 hours. For now, I leave you with wise words by Abraham Maslow, and I quote, "If the essential core of the person is denied or suppressed, he gets sick, sometimes in obvious ways, sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes immediate, later, unquote. Tune in again next week, same day, same time. Goodbye.